This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Republicanism was once distinct from conservatism, but they've become increasingly synonymous, writes my guest Peter Skoblik in his new book, U.S. versus Them. The book connects the Bush administration's foreign policy with conservatives like William Buckley and Barry Goldwater, and a worldview that grew out of the Cold War, refusing to coexist with evil regimes, emphasizing military solutions to problems, and shunning diplomacy as appeasement. Skoblik tells the story of post-World War II conservatism by focusing largely on nuclear policy. He's the executive editor of The New Republic and former editor of Arms Control Today. He wrote U.S. versus Them while a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a visiting researcher at Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. Peter Skoblik, welcome to Fresh Air. You describe your book as a mystery story. What's the mystery you're trying to solve?
The mystery I was trying to solve is why the Bush administration behaved the way it did after 9/11. I assumed that after 9/11, the Bush administration would prioritize not only the war against terrorism, but the war against nuclear terrorism specifically, which was a far more serious version of the horror that we faced on September 11th. And yet, instead of pursuing that threat, the administration invaded Iraq first, in part because it thought it had a nuclear program. But interestingly, or confusingly, at the same time, we knew that both Iran and North Korea, the other members of the so-called Axis of Evil, had far more advanced nuclear programs. And so I wondered why the administration prioritized Iraq, and then I wondered why did it deal with the way it dealt with North Korea and Iran after it invaded Iraq, essentially not supporting military action against those states, but not really supporting diplomatic engagement with them as well.
Why did that send you back to the 1950s and the emerging new conservatism in that Cold War era?
Because while there had been many, many critiques of the Bush administration's foreign policy, I thought that most of them had been descriptive, not explanatory. People criticized the administration as being unilateralist or militarist or imperialist, but that didn't tell me why were they unilateralist, why were they militarist, why were they imperialist. And so I really wanted to get to the ideological roots of the administration's foreign policy. And when I looked back at the 50s and the way that the new conservative movement approached the Cold War, and in particular nuclear policy during the Cold War, I started noticing a shocking number of similarities between what had happened 50 years ago and what had happened after 9/11.
You look at William Buckley, the founder of National Review, and one of the fathers of conservatism as we know it today. What points of view, what groups did he bring together under his type of conservatism and through his podium of National Review?
Well, conservatism was really in disarray after World War II. And what William F. Buckley did was unite three emerging strands of thought. The first was an economic libertarianism, which thought that contra the New Deal, the government should have as little role in the economy as possible. The second strand were traditionalists, sort of social and religious traditionalists, who felt that the post-war America was veering toward a pop culture mentality, a moral relativism, and a lack of respect for religion that was leading us down the road to perdition. But most importantly, you had a very strong strain of anti-communism that was the priority for the new conservatism and also helped link libertarians and traditionalists who didn't necessarily see eye to eye on a lot of things.
And what was the link? How did anti-communism link the traditionalists and the libertarians?
Well, if you think about it, communism was really the ultimate nightmare scenario for both. Libertarianism holding that, you know, there should be minimal government intervention in the economy, and communism representing the diametric opposite, complete government control of the economy. Religious traditionalism, believing that religion should play a very strong role in American society. And communism, again, at the opposite end of the spectrum, really, you know, not only discouraging but banning religion and you know, holding, according to traditionalists, atheism at its core. And the anti-communism of the right, you know, united those two strands of the new conservatism. And they also, you know, provided a rationale in and of itself, in the sense that the United States faced a national security threat from the Soviet Union and from its communist proxies and allies, and needed to be fought. And of course, that was a common refrain in U.S. foreign policy at the beginning of the Cold War. There were very few people who did not consider the Soviet Union a threat. But what conservatives did differently was to see the Cold War not simply as a struggle between two nation states, the United States and the Soviet Union, or even between two ideologies in terms of, you know, democratic capitalism versus communism. They saw it in moral, almost religious terms. They saw it as a battle between good and evil. And while a lot of people would agree both then and now that the United States was and is a force for good and that the Soviet Union was a force for evil, seeing the Cold War in those terms and actually using that Manichaean approach as a guide to U.S. foreign policy was not productive. In fact, it was very counterproductive.
Well, do you hear echoes of that language in the Bush administration and the war in Iraq?
Right. I mean, you can't, you know, think back to late 2001 after the 9/11 attacks or 2002 and 2003 and not recall President Bush speaking very clearly in terms of evil. You know, the terrorists were evildoers. Osama bin Laden was the evil one. You hear less of that language now, but it was a clue to me that there might be some link between the way that conservatism approached the Cold War, the Soviet Union, and nuclear strategy during that time, and how the Bush administration might be approaching foreign policy.
Now, you know, conservative thinkers were anti-interventionist on the whole before World War II and right after World War II. You trace it to Buckley, really, and the Cold War thinking in the 1950s that had a much stronger interventionist strain. You know, confront the Soviets. Don't just, like, negotiate with them. Don't back down.
Right. You know, in some ways, there was a really sharp pivot between the isolationism that many conservatives held before World War II and the active interventionism that they propounded after World War II. And, you know, to some extent, that pivot occurred simply because communism presented itself as a threat not only to the United States, as I said, but also to the very values that conservatives really held dear. And they just, you know, they didn't think they could sit this one out. At the same time, there were a lot more similarities between the isolationism of the pre-World War II era and the subsequent interventionism that I think we realize. The isolationism was, in many ways, an heir to the American exceptionalism that has characterized U.S. foreign policy, you know, since the founding of the country, where the United States has very much wanted to do its own thing, very much afraid of becoming a plaything of the great powers in Europe during, let's say, the 18th and 19th centuries. And the isolationism that characterized a lot of U.S. foreign policy during those centuries was really a way of preventing the United States from being put in a subordinate role. And that is what conservatives were espousing before World War II. Now, after World War II, they decided the United States should be involved on the world stage. At the same time, the United States had become so powerful in the wake of World War II that even becoming involved on the world stage did not necessitate subordinating our interests to the interests of others. We became involved in an entangling alliance known as NATO. But the fact of the matter is that the United States, being so powerful, was really the one that ran NATO. And so the isolationism of the pre-war period sort of morphed relatively cleanly into what was really a unilateralism in the post-war period.
You write also a lot about Barry Goldwater, Senator Barry Goldwater, and his contributions to this new Cold War conservatism. And you describe him as an absolutist. He wanted us to win at the 1964 Republican National Convention. He was famous for saying, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is not vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." What do you see as Goldwater adding to this new conservatism?
I don't know that Goldwater added so much as he was as he represented the new conservatism on the national political stage. Because conservatism had essentially been, in its old form, had been done in by World War II and the Great Depression, conservatives after the war just didn't have a real strong voice in national politics. And when Barry Goldwater became more prominent, he was really the mouthpiece for this new conservatism. And he was very much tied to the conservatism that was being espoused by, you know, journals like National Review. Brent Bozell, who worked with William F. Buckley Jr. on National Review, was actually the ghostwriter of Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, his famous manifesto. And so, you know, Goldwater was essential in bringing these new ideas to a broader public.
Goldwater objected to negotiations with the Soviets, even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis in which nuclear war was averted because of negotiations. What were his objections to negotiating with the Soviets?
Goldwater was, you know, typifying conservatism in the sense that he saw the Soviet Union as evil, and therefore, by definition, any negotiation with evil was, you know, making a deal with the devil. It was just morally anathema. And if you begin from that principle, you find yourself making some rather strange, counterproductive, and even dangerous stands, like opposing negotiation with the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I mean, I see Goldwater's position there as, you know, what I call in the book a crucial case test. If conservatives weren't willing to negotiate with the Soviets at this moment of extreme peril, where really the only answer to the problem was to talk and try to ratchet down tensions, then they were unlikely to embrace negotiations at any point. And in fact, if you then follow this ideology through the rest of the Cold War, and I would argue in the Bush administration, you see a lot of rejection of negotiation over and over again, even when it seems to be clearly in the U.S. interest.
Give us one or two Bush examples where you hear that.
I mean, I think that the Bush administration has clearly echoed that in its approach to both North Korea and Iran, where it has for a long time refused to negotiate with North Korea, for a long time refused to negotiate with Iran. And although that stance has changed somewhat over the past few years with North Korea and just in the last few weeks with Iran, what you've seen via its failure to negotiate is that not engaging these countries allowed them to pursue their nuclear programs unfettered for years. North Korea was able to reprocess more plutonium for its nuclear weapons program, and Iran's uranium enrichment program continues apace.
And you say that the Bush administration's biggest success on the nuclear front was getting the Libyans to abandon their nuclear program through negotiations.
Right. I mean, Libya is sort of the exception that proves the rule with the Bush administration. There were a lot of people in the administration, namely John Bolton, who didn't want to engage Libya. But the U.S. and the British had been negotiating with the Libyans for some time. And ultimately, the administration agreed that if Libya gave up its WMD programs, particularly its nuclear programs, the United States would not seek regime change there. And, you know, lo and behold, we have a successful instance of denuclearizing what had really been a rogue regime.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Skoblik. He's the executive editor of The New Republic and author of the new book, U.S. versus Them, How a Half Century of Conservatism Has Undermined America's Security. He's the author of the new book, U.S. versus Them. And the book traces certain positions and policies of the Bush administration to the new conservatism of the Cold War that began in the 1950s with William Buckley and Barry Goldwater. Skoblik is the executive editor of The New Republic and the former editor of Arms Control Today. As the arms negotiation era starts, you see this big split in American policy between the people who thought that the Soviets were purely ideologically motivated and were pure evil, and those who thought that the Soviet regime was more power-oriented, what they wanted was power. So how did that split between whether the Soviets were more about ideology or power create a split in opinions about how to approach them on nuclear weapons?
Well, if the Soviet Union was evil, if you see the Soviet Union as evil, and as I've said, you don't really have anything to talk with them about because you're not going to agree to become more evil just to sate the Soviets, and it's not going to advance your interests. But if you see the Cold War as more of a traditional power struggle in which the Soviet Union has interests and the United States has interests, and those interests may not always be the same, but they may overlap in places, then you can use negotiation to identify those places and advance the interests of both countries. And for sort of realists or pragmatists and liberals, the area of overlap or the most important area of overlap there was avoiding nuclear war. And they believed that it was important to negotiate a sort of nuclear coexistence with the Soviets so that nuclear war did not come about, either accidentally or intentionally, because both sides thought they might have something to gain from that. And that is, the idea that arms control grew out of. Conservatives disagreed with that. They believed that the Soviet Union was essentially on an unstoppable quest to take over the world. Their nuclear arsenal was one element of that. And, they thought that the United States, by negotiating, really was engaged in what they called unilateral disarmament. In reality, what arms control was trying to do was to stabilize the arms race, stabilize deterrence, so that nuclear war did not erupt.
Did you see both of those conflicting points of view represented within the Reagan administration?
You did. And in fact, you saw them both represented by President Reagan himself. Both of these approaches were represented in a single man. During the first term of the Reagan administration, the president was very much on the side of what you might call the nuclear war fighters, the people that believed that deterrence was sort of a sham, that it was in essence, a form of nuclear coexistence with the Soviets. And once again, coexistence with evil was not something conservatives wanted to tolerate. Why would you tolerate nuclear coexistence? The reason was that you didn't have a choice. It was just sort of, what they called mutual assured destruction was just a fact of life. But there was a group of conservatives who believed that you could seek victory over the Soviet Union even in a nuclear sense. And so they advocated not only an increased nuclear arsenal for the United States, but they also advocated things like missile defense, most famously through the Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars, and even civil defense, bomb shelters, so that if a war ever were to occur, some percentage of our population might survive. And Reagan followed these prescriptions, and he rejected arms control negotiations or serious arms control negotiations for the first half of his administration, and then later in his administration completely turned around.
What was responsible for that change of heart in Reagan?
Well, it's I hesitate to provide a single cause for what changed, but there is one incident that I think helped illustrate for Reagan the danger of the course that he was on, and this is a little-known episode in late 1983 called the Able Archer Exercise, which might be the second most dangerous episode during the Cold War after the Cuban Missile Crisis. 1983 was a very bad year for U.S.-Soviet relations. Reagan had given his evil empire speech. He had called for the deployment of the Star Wars missile defense system. He had become extremely angry at the Soviets after they shot down a Korean airliner that killed many civilians, including Americans. The United States was on the verge of deploying Pershing missiles to Western Europe, nuclear missiles to Western Europe. And on the other side, the Soviet leader was Yuri Andropov, who was former head of the KGB, a fairly paranoid fellow who believed that the United States might be contemplating a nuclear first strike. And he had told his intelligence apparatus to keep an eye out for this, keep an eye out for early warning signs. And in November of 83, he thought that he saw that sign. NATO launched a military exercise, which they did at least once a year, and it was called Able Archer. But this exercise happened to be a little bit more realistic than exercises in the past. And the Soviets thought that they might be seeing preparations for a first strike and actually put some of their nuclear forces on alert. And obviously the episode ended without a nuclear war. But when Reagan got the sort of the after-action report on this from the CIA, A couple months later, he was really aghast. He was aghast at the idea that the Soviets might think that we would actually contemplate something so horrific as a nuclear first strike. And in 1984, he began putting out diplomatic feelers to the Soviet Union. And when Mikhail Gorbachev came into power the next year, in 1985, Reagan found or thought that he had found someone he could work with. And the administration's approach became far less one of confrontation, far more one of engagement.
Now, you write about Reagan that even when he decided he wanted to negotiate with Gorbachev and get rid of nuclear weapons, or at least get rid of a lot of nuclear weapons, that he didn't really understand much about how nuclear weapons or nuclear policy really worked. What were some of the gaps in his understanding?
Yeah, it turned out that Reagan was something of a nuclear abolitionist, meaning he felt deeply about getting rid of all nuclear weapons. And it's very difficult for historians to reconcile that notion with the things that he did during his first term, including, you know, building up nuclear weapons and pursuing missile defense and all that. But if you look at Reagan's statements about nuclear weapons, you realize that he was really very ignorant about the not only the specifics, but really the generalities of nuclear weapons policy. He, as I note in the book, he once told a group of congressmen that bombers and submarines did not carry nuclear weapons, which, of course, they did. At one point, he said that submarine-launched ballistic missiles could be recalled once in flight, which is absolutely not true. He told his national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft, that he didn't realize the principal threat from the Soviet Union was that its ICBMs might destroy ours on the ground in a preemptive strike, even though that was one of the issues that Reagan had run for the presidency on. And Gorbachev had a similar reaction when he met Reagan. At first, he thought that he was sort of a bellicose guy who was trying to threaten the Soviets. He eventually came to realize that Reagan was sincere about nuclear abolition, and that the statements he made that seemed to contradict that sprang not from antagonism, but from ignorance.
So you write that when Reagan started negotiating with Gorbachev, it really alienated a lot of the conservatives in the Reagan administration and a lot of conservatives outside of the Reagan administration. And yet when those negotiations with Gorbachev helped lead to the end of the Soviet Union, conservatives were happy to take credit for it. So can you talk a little bit about that divide and how you think that Reagan was maybe misinterpreted by the conservatives, or rather that the conservatives assumed false credit for the end of the Soviet Union?
When Reagan started negotiating with Gorbachev, when he began seriously negotiating with Gorbachev, and particularly when they came to agreement on a treaty eliminating intermediate-range nuclear missiles, conservatives really thought that Reagan had been taken for a ride, that he had been seduced by this charming Mikhail Gorbachev, who seemed to have captured the attention of the world stage. You know, George Will was characterizing Ronald Reagan as naive. National Review, which had seen Reagan's election as sort of the epitome of their movement, ran a cover dubbing the treaty Reagan's suicide pact. And so they were really very upset about this and thought that he had lost his edge. And during the 1988 presidential race, during the Republican primaries, the Republican candidates, including George H.W. Bush, who is thought of as a realist, as a pragmatist, actually tried to run to Reagan's right on these issues. But as you say, when, you know, the Berlin Wall fell and ultimately the Soviet Union collapsed, conservatives looked back and they decided that it must have been Reagan's conservative policies that ended the Soviet Union. It must have been Reagan's moral clarity, his willingness to speak in terms of good versus evil, his willingness to build up the American military and its nuclear arsenal, his willingness to call for missile defenses, that had really scared the Soviets to the point where they just capitulated. They couldn't keep up with the United States. And they kind of forgot about the Reagan that they had criticized during the second term. Instead, they focused on the peace through strength guy that was the Reagan of the first term. And it made for a compelling narrative. It is a narrative that, you know, we've heard during this presidential cycle, during the primaries. It's one that I think we'll continue to hear as the election goes on. The problem with it is that it's not really true. There's not a tremendous amount of evidence or there's very little evidence to support this interpretation of history. Ultimately, the Soviet Union collapsed because communism was not a tenable form of government and had been eroding the Soviet economic base for decades. And that was true when Gorbachev came into power. It was true 5 years earlier when Reagan came into power. And while I think that, you know, you don't want to downplay the role that Reagan played in peacefully ending the Cold War, I think that the Reagan of the first term did a lot more to heighten the risk of nuclear conflict with the Soviets than did the Reagan of the second term, who realized that Gorbachev was a different kind of Soviet leader, one we could work with, one who no longer wanted to wage this global struggle with the United States.
How would you compare the Bush administration's position on arms talks and missile defense to the Reagan of the first administration and the Reagan of his second administration?
Well, there are a lot of parallels. This administration came into office even before 9/11, not believing that arms control had anything to offer. They thought that, you know, arms control with Russia to, let's say, reduce the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals was a Cold War relic. They thought the ABM Treaty, which essentially prohibited national missile defenses, was also a Cold War relic. And so they pulled out of that treaty and began to try to deploy missile defenses. And, you know, the reason for that was similar to the reason that the Reaganauts had wanted to do it, 20 years earlier, which is that they didn't think that negotiation could provide for U.S. security. Rather, U.S. security was best achieved through military means. And so you saw not only a rejection of negotiation with the Russians, but a rejection of international treaties, the rejection of engagement with North Korea and Iran that we've already talked about. And you even saw them embrace one of the more radical elements of first-term Reagan, which was an emphasis on usable nuclear weapons. That is, you know, weapons that are not used simply to deter a nuclear attack by another state, but weapons that you might use first in a conflict. And so the Bush administration began pursuing what were called low-yield nuclear weapons. They pursued something called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, which is designed to destroy deeply buried bunkers or hardened targets. And this is fairly remarkable, given that it was an extreme policy when we were facing a nuclear-armed adversary. It's a particularly extreme policy when the Cold War has ended. The United States is militarily dominant by any measure, and yet this administration was still turning toward offensive nuclear weapons as a way to advance the U.S. nuclear interest.
Is the Bush administration still trying to pursue offensive nuclear weapons and missile defense?
You've really seen something of a move back, less because of changes in the administration than because of pushback by Congress. The administration is still pursuing missile defenses, although the missile defenses have yet to be proved effective. But they are not pursuing the robust nuclear earth penetrator or low-yield weapons because Congress refused to go along with those. There is, however, still a push for something called the reliable replacement warhead, which is, in theory, not supposed to increase the abilities of our arsenal, but simply to make it safer and more sustainable. But, of course, a lot of critics and a lot of foreign countries see the development of any new nuclear warhead as antagonistic.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Skoblik. He's the executive editor of The New Republic and author of the new book, U.S. Versus Them. And it's kind of a history of the post-World War II Cold War conservative movement and how you can see the influence of that in the Bush administration's policies and positions. You know, we talked about how before the Cold War, conservatism was very non-interventionist, didn't even want to get involved in World War II. But during the Cold War, conservatism becomes much more about a willingness to confront evil like the Soviet Union, as opposed to negotiating with them. Don't give in, don't back down. Strengthen your nuclear defenses as opposed to negotiating down with the Soviet Union, you know, through nuclear treaties. We see an interventionist streak in the Bush administration through the idea of spreading democracy in Iraq and the Middle East. And, you know, one of the theories behind the Iraq war was that if we invade Iraq, overthrow Saddam Hussein, help create a democracy there, the democratic impulse would spread through the Middle East. Can you connect the dots for us on that, the way you see it, how conservative philosophy that begins as non-interventionist now has the strain of intervene, practice regime change to spread democracy?
Yeah, that is actually where I think we can safely bring in the neoconservatives as opposed to the conservatives. Conservatives tend to, you know, as you noted, since the beginning of the Cold War, believe in intervention abroad if it serves U.S. national interests. And post 9/11, they certainly propounded that viewpoint as well. But it was more the neoconservatives who grew out of a group of sort of erstwhile liberals who had supported Harry Truman, but then became disillusioned with the Democratic Party in the 1970s as the party became sort of anti-Vietnam War and associated with George McGovern and things like that. These one-time liberals really thought that it was important to continue to confront communism strongly and militarily, and so they left the Democratic Party, really became allied with the Reaganauts, and took on this moniker neoconservatism. Then after the Cold War ended, as everybody on the left, right, and center was sort of trying to figure out what the purpose of U.S. foreign policy was, the neoconservatives stepped up and said, you know, why don't we try to serve U.S. interests by going abroad in search of monsters to destroy? You know, there's a lot of evil in the world. The United States should crush these regimes and roll them back. And they were speaking, you know, not only of places like North Korea, Iraq, and Iran, but, you know, even China was very much a focus of the neoconservatives. And so in Iraq, what you saw was an alliance between conservatives and neoconservatives. Neoconservatives thought, or let me start with conservatives who thought that Iraq presented a national security threat, and post 9/11, we couldn't allow threats like that to fester, so they supported the war. Neoconservatives believed in that as well, but they had a broader vision that underlie their support for the war. They thought that if we brought democracy to Iraq, we might plant a seed that resulted in the liberalization of the entire region. And so there were two different schools of thought supporting the Iraq war on the right, but they came to common cause, even if they didn't necessarily agree about what was most important about the Iraq war. Just to give one quick example, if you ask John Bolton, who's often called a neoconservative but is not, is really just a straight Goldwater conservative, about democratizing Iraq, he'll just sort of laugh at you. And he said to me jokingly, you know, if it had been up to me, we would have invaded Iraq, handed the Iraqis a copy of the Federalist Papers and left. He didn't really have any interest in democratizing or nation building there.
And looking at the Bush administration and its policies and positions as being historically connected to the conservatism that emerged during the Cold War, you basically come to this conclusion, that it's a problem to cast our national interests in ideological or moral terms. Much more productive to cast our national interests in empirical terms. I want you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, let me take as an example nuclear proliferation, which, you know, the book is an intellectual history of conservatism in some ways that just uses nuclear issues as kind of a case study, showing how conservatism has impacted foreign policy. Nuclear proliferation is a complicated issue, but it's one whose success or failure can be quantified. That is to say, if a country develops more nuclear weapons or more nuclear material, you can say that that's been a failure for U.S. security. If it goes in the other direction, then it's a success. And I think that in looking at, let's say, North Korea, if we approach North Korea simply from the standpoint of saying, what policy gives us the greatest return? What policy locks up or destroys the greatest amount of fissile material, we will come to the policy that best serves the interest of the United States. If we muddy that in talking about how evil the North Koreans are, how they might cheat, how sort of nasty the regime is, then we get sidetracked. All of those things may be true, and we certainly do need to be careful of the North Koreans cheating. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is preventing a nuclear weapon from going off in a U.S. city. And if we concentrate on locking up weapons, locking up material, destroying material, then we're going to be safer at the end of the day. And you don't need, quote-unquote, moral clarity to reach that conclusion. You need an empirical approach, an experience-based approach, a pragmatic approach to foreign policy.
Just wondering where you see the Bush administration policy on Iran heading. Do you think we're heading toward a military strike against Iran, or do you think that Israel is?
Well, it's a fascinating question, certainly one that everyone is focused on right now. Many people have worried that certainly Israel is preparing a nuclear strike against Iran. I think it's unlikely that the Bush administration would strike Iran directly in the final months of its presidency. But then we've had this, you know, new piece of information emerge just in the last couple of weeks here, which is that the United States sent a high-ranking diplomat to sit at the table and with the EU nations, France, Germany, Britain, and also Russia and China to talk to Iran and try to get them to either scale back or eliminate entirely their uranium enrichment program. And that's a really significant shift. It's one that is not explained by the ideological framework that I discuss in this book. It's a shift away from that. And what I think is that it represents, in essence, an admission of failure by the Bush administration, a recognition that conservatism applied, you know, as it was by a number of people during the Cold War or espoused, you know, by Barry Goldwater during the Cold War and fulfilled during the first term of the Bush administration, really hasn't advanced U.S. interests. It's allowed Iran to continue its nuclear program. And, you know, fortunately, but unfortunately very belatedly, the Bush administration seems to have come to that conclusion.
Peter Skoblik, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Peter Skoblik is the author of the new book, U.S. Versus Them, and is the executive editor of The New Republic. You can download podcasts of our interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. In 1965, a group of Chicago composers and improvisers organized themselves as the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians. The AACM is still active. The many leading musicians who've come out of it include the Art Ensemble of Chicago, pianist Muhal Richard Abrams, saxophonists Henry Threadgill, Anthony Braxton, and Edward Wilkerson, and flutist Nicole Mitchell. Also, trombonist George Lewis, who's the author of a big new book on the AACM. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's really, really good.
New York avant-garde jazz of the 1960s, a bit heavy, compared to the new music emerging in Chicago in the same period. That's the 1966 Roscoe Mitchell Sextet that evolved into the Art Ensemble of Chicago, spare and somber with a hint of slapstick. That first loud music we heard was New York's Jazz Composers Orchestra, an offshoot of the Jazz Composers Guild, an all-for-one and one-for-all musicians co-op that lasted about a year. By contrast, the co-op founded in Chicago, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, is 43 years old, with chapters in Chicago and New York. It's the subject of a big new book by AACM trombonist, composer, and writer of interactive software, and the head of Columbia's Center for Jazz Studies, George Lewis. George Lewis's book is called A Power Stronger Than Itself, The AACM and American Experimental Music. It's rich and dense and gratifyingly readable. Lewis tells how a bunch of working-class African-American musicians banded together to clear a space for themselves, to compose original music that moved freely among jazz, classical, marches, spirituals, and any other genres they studied or fancied. These composers were postmodern before that became a buzzword, and they've stayed true to their ideals. Here's a sliver of a piece by Muhal Richard Abrams, one of the AACM's founders and one of George Lewis's heroes. For blurring musical genres, AACM composers sometimes found themselves accused of being not jazzy enough for jazz and too jazzy for classical music. In his book, George Lewis shows how black composers are conceptually boxed in and underfunded compared to white colleagues. Where, say, his friend John Zorn is praised for his wide-ranging interests as a composer, black composers like saxophonist Anthony Braxton take flack for straying too far from jazz roots. George Lewis affirms the right of African-American composers to be as mobile and unfettered in musical culture as everywhere else. He's great at pointing up double standards and faulty logic in the arts discourse that marginalize black artists. And he does it with a dispassionate understatement more devastating than righteous fury. Lester Bowie. George Lewis describes his AACM book as the autobiography of a collective. He interviewed dozens of the co-op's members and tells their stories from childhood in compact narratives. But the book is less about individual artists than the collective itself, its growing pains and generational frictions included. In celebrating composers who roam across different musical languages, George Lewis accomplishes a parallel feat on the page, creating a narrative with broad appeal that never feels dumbed down. He makes a scholarly portrait of a complex community into a ripping good and inspiring yarn.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas and is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the new book, A Power Stronger Than Itself, The AACM and American Experimental Music, by George Lewis. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menjivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Johnny Griffin, the tenor saxophonist from Chicago who died Friday at the age of 80. He moved to Europe in the early 60s, where he felt his playing was more appreciated than it was in the States. He lived there for the remainder of his life, but he eventually made regular visits to America to tour and record. This is Autumn Leaves from his 1978 album Return of the Griffin, recorded during his first American tour after moving to Europe.